Hello, this is Scott Wells for The Magic Word, and my guest here today is Doug Anderson. Hey, Doug.
Howdy, y'all. How are you?
I'm doing fine. I notice you say howdy because I guess you're from Texas originally, living in Oklahoma now.
That's correct. I move up to Oklahoma on purpose.
No, you say move up to Oklahoma. I guess geographically, and I guess that's true. You're moving north.
Correct.
So you're moving up, but whenever you move from Texas, that's not necessarily always moving up.
Well said. Well said.
Well, Wells said. Scott Wells, that's me. It's there. Never mind. I got a stretch. So anyhow, I appreciate you being here today, and the reason you stopped by is because we were on a little lecture tour then right now.
That's correct. Yes, I did the show for you Saturday night. That was a lot of fun. A lot of great people there in the audience, and good to see some old friends again.
Yep.
And yes, they have gotten old, just like myself. And then I drove up to, on Sunday, I drove up and did a show at a church halfway up to Dallas, and then did the lecture for you for the Dallas Magic Club, and then back down here to do the lecture for you tonight.
Yeah.
for all the wonderful magicians here in Houston.
Looking forward to that. I know you got some more that are going to be from here on out to Las Vegas as well. I mean, your tour is kind of just beginning, so to speak, in the middle.
I would say sort of in the middle, yes.
Last weekend that you did the show for toptalentproductions.com, and that was a lot of fun. We got Harry Maurer coming up next month. It's kind of interesting. We have two back-to-back cruise ship magicians.
Yes. And I tell you, Harry's show is well worth seeing. He does a really fine job. So
he has performed for us in the past and back the house, and we're looking forward to having him come back then again.
So great guy too. Yeah. He and his wife Carol Ann, just
right.
Sweetheart.
Right. Well, I wanted just to chat with you just a little bit about some of the things that I have found of interest about you over the past that some people may not know. That let's go back kind of...
First of all, I don't have a dog. I've never owned a dog. So whatever story you heard, it ain't true.
And the thing with the charges about that clown that have been dismissed.
Yes, they have.
Okay.
He was such a jerk. He deserved it.
Fondles the clown?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I don't know him. Or I've erased him or her from my memory, whoever Fondles may be.
What a name for a clown. I think I have to thank Bob Rees for that one. He came up with that years ago. I was going to talk about theme park magic.
Yes.
And going back to Paul Osborne. Now, you were from Dallas originally, and you worked at Jeffrey's Magic Land?
That's correct. I got my start. I got interested in magic watching a TV show called The Magician, starring Bill Bixby. A lot of magicians did get their start the same way.
Sure.
Back in the early 70s. And my dad took me down to a magic shop in Dallas. We were living in Duncanville, Texas, one of the suburbs of Dallas. My brother used to joke about that because he had a sign in town that said, Duncanville, the superb suburb. And he just had a kind of derogatory that, superb? Come on.
Yeah.
But that is where I grew up and graduated high school. I had the diploma to prove it. I did graduate.
Okay. No GED.
Another one of those rumors you've heard. He took me down to Jeffrey's Magic Land, bought me a couple of tricks. Jeffries was a wonderful man, a good proprietor, and he suggested it to my dad. And later, when I started working there at the magic shop as a demonstrator, we did the same thing that Gene Jeffries did to my dad. He said, I would suggest you buy him two tricks at a time. One that is sort of self-working, like, I think most magicians are familiar with nickels to dimes.
Right.
It's pretty much a self-working trick.
Pretty much.
And he also bought me a set of sponge balls, which is not
right.
a self-working trick. And he said he will get the instant gratification of being able to fool people with the self-working trick.
Mm-hmm.
You will know that if he's really serious about being a magician or sticking with it, if he also practices and learns how to do the sleight of hand sponge balls.
Yeah, they're required by the sponge balls. Sure.
Exactly. So every time we went, we always got two tricks, one that was sort of self-working and others that were sleight of hand. And it taught me a very valuable lesson early on that, you know, I couldn't change four nickels to four dimes and, well, I don't have my little brass cap with me.
Yeah.
But I could do the sponge ball routine with tissue paper. I learned later that you should use tissue paper that hadn't been used yet. The little important things that you pick up along the way, you know. And
a little helpful tip you learn here on The Magic Word.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, when I started working cruise ships, that proved invaluable because I would be in different ports of call and I would need lighter fluid, say, for the vanishing candle, not to be found on any of the islands on our itinerary. So that was one trick that I couldn't do.
Yeah.
So I started learning very quickly that you needed to be able to do things that could be easy duplicated, or certainly effects that you would be able to use other things instead of that, you know, that particular prop.
Right, right.
And that's what the shoot from the hip lecture has a lot to deal with, is things that are easily replaced without not necessarily going to. Was that a double negative? Without not necessarily?
It is.
I apologize for that.
Yeah, so in other words, it is necessary.
Well, like my English teacher said, Doug, don't never use no double negatives, and triple negatives is worse. obviously, my English teacher was from Texas.
As a Texas teacher, not an English teacher then.
Yeah. So I was very fortunate in working at Magicland. Paul Osborne was then called Paul Osborne and Associates. And they produce a lot of theme park shows for Six Flags and Marriott's Great American.
What year would that have been?
Let's see. That would have been, I believe, 79, 1979. Right. And Gene Jeffries said, well, Doug Anderson, you know, is really interested in magic. And just in the event that Paul is listening to this, this will be the first time he has ever heard this. They were looking for somebody that had a knowledge of illusions. Well, Gene let me come into a shop and go through all the illusion books, so I started learning the names. I had no idea. You know, I'm a spiked coin, you know, the little magic drawer that you would open up and it would, things would appear and disappear.
Yeah.
So I started learning these things. So when they said, you know, like sawing in half, I said, oh, yes, uh-huh. So I knew, you know, the Venn model sawing in half. And what the problem was is they were getting people that weren't magically inclined working in the shipping department. And they would send all these illusions out to a theme park show in a different state, and they would get there without the sword for the sword basket.
Okay.
You know, they wouldn't have any
something
of the swords.
Something missing that would be
yeah, exactly, something
part of
vital.
The yeah.
So, you know, this, you know, multi-$1,000 show suddenly can't go on because you don't have that center sword for this particular box to
right.
hide the, you know, the gimmick. But so, and because I so much wanted to perform, after proving my worth, I guess, I don't know, maybe I was the only one that would work for the amount of money that they were willing to pay, which incidentally was more than I was making at the time working at a gas station. So I was pretty happy with that. I got to
high school education came in handy, didn't it?
It sure did. I could read the numbers on that air pressure gauge, so I knew exactly how much air pressure they had in their tires. But
so
Paul gave me the opportunity. I refurbished illusions. You know, illusions would come in from a show. They'd have chipped, you know, legs and things like that. And I would, you know, celastic them or bondo them back up and repaint them and all sorts of things like that.
Yeah.
And pack them up for next season shows wherever they were going
to. So you were one of his associates, basically.
I wasn't one of the high paid, one of the three. It was Paul, Hardy Haberman, and Doug Litton. And I think since Doug has passed away and Hardy still lives in Dallas and obviously, Paul and his lovely wife, Michelle, still live in Dallas.
Yeah.
But Paul gave me an opportunity, as he has given many young magicians the opportunity, to do a show without worrying about the financial overhead of having to purchase all these illusions, or paying somebody to assemble all the music tracks for it, or even theme the show in a cohesive order.
Yeah.
So, as a, you know, it's an opportunity that I will be eternally grateful for, because I got to do 5-6 illusion shows per day, 6, sometimes 7 days per week, for an entire summer run, which could last 4 or 5 months. And you do a show that many times. Imagine now, you're sitting here in your garage or your rehearsal studio area, and you go through your entire 23-minute show or 45-minute show 6 times a day, 6 days a week, for 10 years,
yeah,
you're going to know that inside and out.
You better.
You're going to know things that can go wrong, that will go wrong, and you'll also learn how to cover for them.
Mm-hmm.
So we were able to do that.
Well, not only that, you know, you had the benefit of having an audience. In other words, if you're doing that in front of a mirror or in your garage or just on your own, you can do that all you want, but the timing and misdirection are two things you cannot rehearse. You have to have a live audience. And so by having an audience...
Exactly right.
Yeah.
And I was able to lean on the expertise and experience of Paul Osborne and Hardy Haberman, that they already knew that this particular angle won't work because they'll see how it works.
Sure.
But if you angle it this way a little bit, so I was being taught all these things that as I go back and look at them now and go, wow, that was incredible. That's something that I'm not going to pay him back, but I should have paid him for the opportunity, if you understand what I mean.
Sure.
And I think the same thing with the ability to work close-up magic in restaurants, to be able to do close-up magic 3 hours a night, you know, three or four nights a week for an extended run. You get very good at the close-up magic that you do as well. And that's also the opportunity to trade out and work in a new trick here and there.
That's right, because you have some hardy stuff, some stuff that's actually going to work, and you know it's tried and true and commercial and whatnot, and then you can try something new to kind of throw in there and then work on that material. Then you can polish that if it looks like that it's got some potential.
Exactly right. And as you rise in certain levels and certain expectations, like on a cruise ship, for instance, you get paid really, really well for doing very, very minimal amount of work. There was a cruise ship that I worked here recently. It was a 7-day cruise. I only had to do two performances of the same show on the very last night of the cruise. I had 6 days off to play in the sun and have fun, and all that was required of me is that last. But that 45 minutes times two had darn well better be the best, highest quality entertainment that I can provide, because the night before me was the Texas Tenors.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's the kind of competition, so to speak, that I'm up against.
Sure.
I certainly had to bring my level of the entertainment up a lot, and I appreciate all the advice that I was given by other entertainers, singers, and marimba players, and xylophone players, and jugglers, and ventriloquists, and that had, you know, been there many years before that taught me the ropes.
Oh, well, before we go on to cruise ships, I don't get too far ahead. I was going to ask you about the theme parks and everything then too. Now you work a lot of places all over the country, I guess, traveling with.
That's correct.
Did you go and help set them up, train the dancers, or what?
My first theme park actually was, I got it myself, and that was working at Six Flags Over Texas. And the Cyrus Cosmo, which is a Paul Osborne character, Cyrus Cosmo's Boogie Woogie Magic Shop. And I did that in 76 during the summer months, you know, in high school, and in 77, the year I graduated high school. 8 hours a day, 30-minute lunch, 15-minute break later on, but doing the same tricks over and over and over again. That's where I developed my color-changing knife routine and the sponge ball routine that I do and several other things. And then that's where I first learned about Paul Osborne, because he had a Cyrus Cosmo magic show there that on breaks I would go over there and watch that show, and we almost had all the lines all memorized. It was so much fun. Well, then when I got hired by Paul, he finally sent me out as a show manager. The first gig was at it was called Magic World in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee.
I've worked there.
Now, everybody here knows now about Pigeon Forge, but back then it was nothing. In fact, I remember I would work sometimes in the morning as a clown to bring people into the parking lot, you know, like you see people on the side with a sign.
Sure.
And I had one of those, you know,
horns.
Kind of horns, exactly. That would.
An Ooga horn.
An Ooga, yes, exactly. horn, and I could squeeze that, and it would emit the sound. And it would take about 4.5 to 5 seconds to hit the mountains and bounce back to me.
Yeah.
Because there was nothing there.
Okay.
Well, now it's wall-to-wall gift shops and curio stores and restaurants and everything else.
Sure.
It is really built up big. But back then, there was two big shows there, the Tommy Bartlett Water Ski Show and Magic World, where we had the Cyrus Cosmo Magic Show.
So when did Dollywood get built?
Dollywood was actually Silver Dollar City.
Oh, so she just
was already built.
Okay.
And actually, when I was working at Magic World, that's where I first met Brian Gillis.
Uh-huh.
Brian Gillis was doing a magic show at Silver Dollar City. An incredible, very funny. And
was he doing Watch Steals back then?
He was doing Watch Steals back then, and he is, bar none, the best I have ever seen.
Yeah.
And Brian is very generous with his ideas, as was Jerry Geyer. And several others that, you know, my wanting to give something back is based on how kind these people were to me.
Yeah.
I want to return that favor to other magicians. So, and I remember after I saw Brian's show several times, I looked at the back wall of the medicine wagon that he was in front of, and I said, like I was reading it. Princess Feather Flowers, Famous Elliptical, Asiatical, Pendicular, Nervous Cordial, and Ending Elixir. And Brian whipped his head around and said, where did you see that? And I said, I didn't. My friend Jerry Geyer taught me his Doc Snooker Medicine Man routine, right, which is the Tommy Windsor Street Faker Act.
Yes.
And I just still had it memorized, which obviously I still have it memorized. But and we became
later.
Friends. And
yeah.
He told me where I could find Whit Hayden's four ring routine, you know, the lecture notes, and I've been doing it since 1977.
Yeah, so have I.
And the card routine, to have several different people pick cards and find them a different way.
Oh, Eddie Fechter's, yeah.
Yes, and that's, he said that's the magic of Eddie, Magician Nightly, the magic,
right,
of Eddie Fechter by Jerry Menzer.
Right.
And so,
I remember seeing you do that at the Magic Castle many years ago.
Back when I was skinny and had hair.
Didn't we all?
Yeah. But I was able to learn these routines, and Brian also gave me a cassette tape of his show, which I think is incredibly generous. Yes, a cassette tape, for those of you youngsters out there, it was an old school version of an MP3.
Or a CD, if you remember those, or an LP.
I know, it's amazing how far technology has come
so
in our
quickly,
lifetime.
Yeah.
But so I learned it, and I learned the pattern. I had it memorized.
Yeah.
So that really helped a lot. Well, then, after Magic World, that lasted one season. I was scheduled to go back, but Tom Levesque was a show manager for Paul at a brand new show they had at Florida Cypress Gardens, when Cypress Gardens did their big expansion thing, mm-hmm, to offer more than just the you know, pretty girls
shows
and the dresses and the ski shows and
right,
the flower gardens.
Right.
And they had a duck show and a wild animal show and a magic show, and obviously we were part of the duck show. No, I mean, the magic show. And so Tom was quitting. So real quick, they whipped it around and said, okay, we're sorry to the owners of Magic World, but we need to send Doug immediately down to Florida. And I remembered Richard Bohansky was Paul Osborne's choreographer. And he came out to me and said, we're not going to be sending you to Magic World,
yeah,
back to Tennessee. We're going to send you to Florida. Oh, great, because I remember helping install some things in Florida and carrying the Illusions down there.
Yeah.
You know, the big U-Haul bobtail truck driving them to Florida. So, that would be neat, because in Magic World, I was inside a costume character. Nobody saw me. In Florida, they would see me.
Yeah, yeah.
And I was such a, dang, Doug, you just come off the turnip truck, that they said, first of all, we need to send you out and have you have a real haircut done.
Yeah.
Because,
did you have long hair back then? Or
no, I don't know. Actually, I had an afro,
okay,
which is scary considering my head now. But Richard came out and said, how soon can you be packed up to move your entire life, all of age 19 or 20 years old, everything you've accumulated so far, and move to Florida? And this was on a Monday, and I said, I would say by Friday for sure. And he said, okay. And he went back, and he came out a few minutes later and said, I'm sorry, you have to be there on Friday. You really need to leave tomorrow. Okay.
Speed up things just a bit.
You know, pedal to the metal, you know.
Yeah.
All right. So this is something that I really, really heart of hearts wanted to do.
Yeah.
So I scrambled, got everything together, told my mom and dad I was still living at home. I'm going to Florida. When? Tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
For how long? Forever. So we got everything packed up, had a trailer hitch on my car. I drove a bunch of stuff down there, and they found me an apartment, and I started doing the Illusion show at Florida Cypress Gardens.
And now that was in the year 77?
Actually, no, now we're up to 81.
Now, were you in charge, performed, or what did you do exactly with them at that time?
When you worked for Paul, you were called
a... By the way, I'm enjoying the cigar. Did you? I just gave you a chance to take a puff on this. This is what? A Royal...
Royal Batura.
Batura.
Yeah, very smooth smoke.
That's why we're sitting outside, in case you hear any background noise, that birds or air conditioning units or whatever out there in this podcast land. Sorry, that the ambient noise, but we're smoking our cigars outside.
This is real. This is as real as real gets.
That's right.
So, it was either in, I think it was 81... unfortunately, due to circumstances beyond their control, Paul Osborne and Associates had to file bankruptcy. Well, Florida Cypress Gardens bought the show outright instead of leasing it, and they hired me on, so I started working directly for the park.
Okay.
So I still had my job, But I was not making very much money at all.
Working for either one of them?
Correct.
Working for Paul or
Correct.
For...
The experience, as I look back on it, was great.
Invaluable, yeah.
Yes, and was well worth it. However, you know, when you're down to saying, okay, I'm going to get a big old bag of beans and I'm going to eat these for however long it takes me to get my next paycheck, that's not a lot of money.
Yeah.
Well, my friend Mark Young was doing a sword swallowing act at Circus World in Haines City, Florida, which is about 20 miles away.
Uh-huh.
And they said, well, we need somebody here to do a fire eating act. And instead of $250 a week, it paid $300 a week. Instead of doing 5, 6, 7 shows a day, 6 days a week, it was only 2 3-minute shows.
Okay.
6 days a week. So, well, heck yes, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
So, Mark taught me how to eat fire. He and magician Ned Way helped me put together a fire eating routine. They set up the audition for me. I went out, I auditioned, I got hired, I went back, I put in my notice, and about a week and a half later, I was working at Circus World eating fire instead of cutting girls in half. Unfortunately, about that time, about 2 months after getting there to this new job, I got a, well, for, unfortunately, because I just started the new job and I hated to leave it, but fortunately, Paul Osborne called me and said, Gene Patrick is producing a show out at Marriott's Great America in Santa Clara, California.
On the other coast.
Correct. And they need somebody to do the magic show there. Well, I had known about Great America because I believe it was in... It was right after I started working for Paul. They had produced a Halloween show called Spooktacular.
Okay.
For that park out in California. And I got to take all the illusions and all the costume characters for Halloween... And the staging and everything else, and Tom Levesque was the magician for it. But I drove everything out there in a truck, set up the stage, you know, all the skirting on the stage and everything else, put it all together. Tom came in and performed the show, and I packed it all up when they were done and drove it back to Texas when it was all done. But this was neat, and I liked that park. Now, wait a minute. You're offering me to be the performer instead of taking everything out and setting it up? Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
So he said, well, Gene wants to meet you. Gene Patrick wants to meet you. I said, well, you know, I'm not sure how that's going to happen. And he said, well, give him a call. So I called Gene, and he said, we'd like to fly you out to California to talk to us about it. And what airport would you be flying out of? And I said, well, probably Tampa. And he said, okay, when can you leave? And when do you have to be back? Well, it was on my day off. So I finished work, eating fire at Circus World. They had pre-bought a ticket for me, which, wow, you know, with the shoestring budget that I was experiencing with Paul, was all of a sudden, you're going to fly me to California for one day? This is so cool.
Yeah.
And flew me out to California, you know, tired and everything else. And I used to hang around with a bunch of practical jokers.
Okay.
And back in those days, if it was somebody's birthday... They'd get him snot-filled drunk and then take him to the airport and buy him a plane ticket one way to somewhere. So when they sobered up, they were in a different city. I mean, that's the kind of practical jokers they were.
Okay.
So
yeah.
My friend Kevin said, don't tell Kevin out in California, another Kevin out in California, because this seems really important to you, and I wouldn't want him to try a practical joke and mess it up.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's a good idea. He hook, line, and sinker had me.
Yeah.
No sooner had I left that he got on the phone and called Kevin and said, Doug's coming out. So when I landed at the airport and I started looking for my luggage, and I found my luggage, a guy came up and said, hey, that's my bag. Okay, I'm still a young kid.
Yeah.
I'm in a big city of San Francisco that you hear all these horror stories about, Shanghai and everything else. And I didn't know, and I said, no, it's not, it's mine. He said, no, man, that's my bag. I went, oh, they're right. This is a place full of crazies. I found out later I was wrong. It's a very nice city and very wonderful people. However, I said, look, here, it says Doug Anderson, which verified to him I was the right guy.
Yeah.
And he goes, you're stealing my bag. Hey, somebody stop this guy. He's trying to steal my bag. And a porter came over.
Yeah.
And I said, sir, I don't know who this guy is. He's accused me of trying to steal the bag. And another girl came up, like she was getting into the fray. I went, oh, no, what's going on? And she said, Doug, it's Kevin Collins. Cindy's outside. I went, Okay, I know that name from somewhere. Where? Oh, yeah, Florida. I said, uh-uh, I want to see her. So they went and got Cindy. She came inside and went, and the porter said, okay, called security off and said it's okay. They really had me going good, too. And so they drove me to the hotel, to the door of the hotel.
Yeah.
Not the parking lot of the hotel, to the door of the hotel. Up on the sidewalk, underneath that awning, right up to those doors that opened by themselves.
Yes.
And let me out at the door.
Okay.
And the guy at the front desk was on the phone, and he was pointing to the vehicle. Yeah.
So driving their lobby.
Exactly. So that's how what fun people I used to hang out with.
Well, with that also, as I understand, like the theme parks, that they didn't often hire magicians, that they would instead just hire people who were like college graduates or dancers or some local kids, maybe working between school or something. And so, again, they were not trained as magicians. They were trained as dancers and how to open boxes and point and things like that. Is that right?
For the magicians, certainly my experiences with Paul Osborne and Gene Patrick, that did not hold true for the most part. The guy that worked on my day off at Florida Cypress Gardens was a guy named Chris Harris. And Chris used to work in the magic shop, so he already had a love and an interest for magic. In fact, he got the job at the magic shop when it first opened. And then they trained him to work on my day off, because they trained him to work on Tom Levesque's day off.
Okay.
So that worked out pretty well, because it was another magician. And the guy that replaced me when I went to Circus World was also a magician. At Marriott's Great America, obviously they brought me in, and they also hired a local gentleman named Dean Hankey. And a lot of people know Dean Hankey with what he does.
Yeah.
And obviously, he was already a magician as well.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and he was doing theme parks too, or
He knew Gene from, I think, children's theater.
Okay.
And Gene knew him and appreciated Gene's talent and abilities. Did I say Gene's? Dean's.
Dean.
Gene appreciated Dean Hankey's talent. Yes, at a very early age, and so we were cast in the show together. Dean played the old professor that was, you know, guiding the young wannabe magician me into the following the theme of the show.
Okay.
So there was another magician that was hired. Now, when the show moved to Illinois, to their other theme park up in Gurnee, Illinois, I believe that Dean already had prior commitments and couldn't make that move with the show. The guy they hired to fill his spot was not a magician. So that's the only instance that I know of where they actually hired somebody that wasn't a magician.
But the other people who were the dancers were not magicians, obviously. Those were just...
Not magicians, had no inkling. Really, I don't
dancers.
Know that how much they even cared to do magic.
They just slipped
they just
in
want
and
to
out.
Dance.
Exactly.
You know, I want to be on Broadway. I don't want to work the Magic Castle. What are you talking about?
Right.
Here's the neat thing. We had all the dancers sign a release.
Yeah.
You know, that they would not divulge the secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember one particular young lady in the show. Her name was Stacy Jones.
Chuck's daughter, yeah.
No. Different. No.
Okay.
Different girl. Great lady. Great dancer. All the girls and boys in the show were great. They
mm-hmm.
they really were. I go back and watch the videotapes of it now and go, I'm astounded.
How good they were.
That they would want me to be a part of it because they were so good.
Yeah.
But I believe it was it Jay Marshall and Phil Temple and Moyo Miller Montes and her husband and several other magicians were in town for the PCAM convention, and we brought them into the theater to see the show and stuck around afterwards. And Patrick Martin with, you know, clones and heart attack.
Sure.
In to see the show and stuck around and showed him the illusions afterwards. And Stacy got really, really mad.
Why was that?
And I said, exactly. I said, why are you mad? She goes, you're not supposed to divulge the secrets. I mean, she really took that oath very seriously.
Yeah.
And I had to explain to her, you understand that these are fellow magicians.
Who already know.
Who are a step above us, quite a few steps above us, you know, certainly in longevity and the shows that they've done.
Right.
So,
we're not divulging.
They probably already know how the tricks work anyway. So it calmed her down. But I thought that was precious and very like, oh, that is so wonderful
that
they're taking it seriously. Exactly right. And I've had people tell me years later when I'll see an assistant and with her husband and kids and stuff, and, you know, hey, you know, how are you doing? And doing great. And you know, had the husband say to me, you know, I've asked her many times how you cut her in half, and she still won't tell me.
That's great.
So
that's a long-lasting effect.
I appreciate
it. He must have signed that in blood or something.
Yeah, I think I scared him with my friends Kevin and Kevin that they would come out and visit him at an airport somewhere.
You wrote the book then also, literally, then on theme park magic. Is that right?
That's correct.
And when did that come out? Tell me something about that.
The theme park magic book came out after my 10th year of working amusement park shows. The first year in Gurnee, Illinois, it was called Marriott's Great America. And that was the It's a Magic World show. Well, in the interim time, I went back to Dallas, got hired to do the show again next year. So I was driving back up and had already moved back to Gurnee to do the show again in 1984. And I was also booked to work the Magic Castle. And this was before the show season started and everything else. So I flew out to do the show at the castle. And I got a phone call from my roommate, who was also our stage manager, and said, the park's been sold. I'm thinking, oh, no.
That's into this gig.
You know, because the castle doesn't pay
that much.
Well, and they don't pay expenses. They don't pay for your airfare. So.
Hey, you get dinner.
Exactly right. And obviously, I had my fill of dinner. I turned a profit on that. But
punish him.
So I'm thinking, okay, and Six Flags has bought it, and the show's going to change up a bit. It's going to be called Rabbit Kadabra, and you'll be starring with a well-known TV personality. Mm-hmm. Well, really, who? Bugs Bunny. Oh, great. Another costume
character
show.
Right.
But it was kind of a kick because Mel Blanc obviously did the voices.
Yes, he was still alive back then. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And at the end of the show, Bugs Bunny turned to me as we all came out for our final battle and said, and now, have a nice round of applause for Doug Anderson. Now, okay, it was a recording, but Mel Blanc actually said my name.
I would love to have had something like that.
Yeah, I know.
I always thought it'd be cool to have Orson Welles to have said that for me. I mean, he was my uncle, after all.
No. Orson Welles was your uncle?
No, but I...
And now I'm a monkey's uncle. Thanks for doing that.
I feel like Kevin.
So then the last year that I worked was Rabbit Kadabra, and this is hopefully just for magicians and nobody else, because in that show, it's a pretty hectic show. It's a 45-minute show with four different costume changes, and I'm jumping through trap doors, and we're doing the metamorphosis illusion, and Dakota chair vanish, and appear in the audience, and all sorts of things. And I had bruises on the underside of my arms that looked like they were just solid black and blue.
Yeah.
You know, for one of the tricks that we did.
Were you doing something wrong, or was it the trap too small?
Well, I learned. Pain is an excellent teacher. And I hope I'm not quoting Nietzsche here or something. But so I learned, okay, well, don't hit that spot anymore, idiot.
Yeah.
So
if I do this, well, don't do that.
Yeah, right. So I realized, you know, I'm not going to be able to do theme parks much more.
Yeah.
Well, a friend of mine, Brett Bullock, in 1982... he played the piano at another show in the park in California at Marriott's Great America. He got hired. Did my voice just crack? He got hired. He got hired to work as a piano player on a cruise ship. And on a cruise ship, what's that?
And what year was this? 80?
This was when, like, the Love Boat had just come out.
At 82.
82.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And so he was, I mean, we were excited because, you know, he said, no, they called me from the cruise ship. They're at sea. He placed a phone call to me.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. That is so cool. Yeah, it's a big deal. And he got hired. Well, at the end of the season, I had a free ticket to Hawaii.
Yeah.
And he was going to be docked in Hawaii. So I flew down to see him.
On the cruise, not a plane.
Yeah, he took me around the ship. Uh-huh. And then I flew back to California. And they ended up moving on back to Texas, then up to Gurnee for the 83 show.
Yeah.
So I knew about cruise ships, and I called Brett, and I talked with him about it, and he's actually the one that loaned me some of the money to print Straight Talk About Theme Park Magic. And I realized, okay, I'm reaching an end to my career.
And theme parks.
Right. So let me write a book about it and teach everybody else how to do it.
Yeah. I'm done with that.
Because I'm not going to be doing it. Exactly.
Yeah.
So
that's almost of a thing of a bygone era. I mean, I don't see magic shows at theme parks nearly like I used to. I may be wrong, but maybe I just don't go to theme parks like when my children were younger. But do they still have them in the different places around?
Here and there, I think a lot of it has to do with economics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's less expensive, even though the insurance is much higher, to build this huge thrill ride that they can publicize and draw an attraction to.
As opposed to a live show.
As opposed to a live show. And that attraction, you don't have to have any kind of skill, i.e. as a dancer or a magician or a singer, to operate the ride.
That's right.
So the upkeep, and they could amortize that over several years, where this show costs this amount for 1 year.
Right.
So in the end, those big rides actually work out.
Plus, you have all your insurance and everything else. I guess they pay, and for the employees, et cetera.
That's right.
Yeah, and when it's done, and you don't have anything. It's like buying or renting an apartment. You know, you don't have
or
anything,
a car,
or
a exactly.
Leasing, yeah, car.
So I wrote the book, and while I was writing the book, and this is during when we had gone back to weekend operation in 1984. I had worked the castle, and I had the videotape from working there. And I started sending that out to several cruise ships. Well, a friend of mine, Carol Wilshire, had worked on a one-day cruise out, you know, gambling ship, out and then back. And she said the magician on board the ship was making $400 a week. I went, well, that's less than I'm making now, but it's a lot easier gig, and it's a cruise ship.
Right. You don't have to pay for
your
food.
So I sent her a videotape. And I sent it out to several different cruise lines. Didn't edit it or anything else. I just sent the videotape of my show.
Right.
And a lot of the cruise lines were booked by an agency called Bramson Entertainment Bureau in New York. Jim Abramson and his father, Ephraim. And they just forwarded all the videotapes straight to Bramson, because he's the one that booked all their acts. Well, Jim called me and said, I've been getting a bunch of your videotapes. I understand that you want to work cruise ships. And I told him about the potential ship that I already had, and he said, well, we can't evaluate you because we don't have an agreement with that cruise line. We can offer you this cruise ship, but you have to get to New York.
On your own.
Right. So it paid $400.
A week.
Yes, and that was only for 1 week.
Yeah.
Well, I forget the name of the cruiser, I think that escapes me, but God love him because, you know, again, fledgling, you know, fresh off the farm. I still didn't know what I was doing.
Yeah.
But I got hired. I did the week. When we docked in Bermuda, I got a phone call to go to the purser's desk. And I went there and said, there's a call from New York for you. Jim Abramson, you got a good report on your show. Yay! we want to offer you another ship that pays $500 a week.
Out of New York also?
No, this one was out of Barbados.
Okay.
And so I said, yes, I accept it. Because I didn't have a job, and I wanted to work cruise ships.
Sure.
So I finished the week, packed everything up, moved back to Texas, packed up stuff, and arranged to fly to Florida. Understand that I'm a two chili dog kind of guy at that time, and a six-pack of beer a night person.
Yeah.
So when I got on board the cruise ship, I only had one suit, and it was a brown suit. And the tie was polyester.
Now, were you hauling Big Illusions with you then?
I was not. I didn't take any Big Illusions with me.
Okay. No.
So, I don't fit in at all. But again, the people there, Dave Brown, Ruth Day, they were all very nice. And you said, you know, we know that you're allowed to sit in this area with passenger status, but they really don't want us to.
Okay.
So, I sat with them. So, they kept me out of trouble that way.
Who were the other performers?
Correct. Yes. And I remember this, I love this story. This is the only suit and tie I own, other than the tuxedo that I'm wearing in the show.
Not that you brought, but you actually own. That's all you got.
Yeah. And there's this fancy menu I don't recognize. I don't see chili dogs and beer. And
yeah, what's this tornado?
I said, I don't know what to order. And they said, well, try the capon. And I'm thinking, okay, like,
a cape on.
Yeah, wear this cape. And you're like, Dracula, what? I said, no, it's chicken. We used to raise chickens on the farm. I know what chicken is. Okay, I'll have that. So they brought it to me.
Sounds like a routine building here.
I got my knife and I got my fork and I got ready to cut into it. And they all went almost simultaneously, wait.
Yeah.
You've never had this before? No. Let the waiter do it. That is full of butter under pressure. And it will squirt all over you if you don't cut it right. And the waiter said, yes, let me do it. I could almost hear under his breath, podunk kid. And he put the fork very carefully and stabbed it with a knife and squirted butter all over the only tie I owned.
It still squirted you in.
I could have done that myself. Come on. But I made it through, and I then, so that was at the end of the first cruise. Then I fly down to Barbados, and I joined the ship en route on the island of St. Vincent. And I didn't know anything. I told my parents, I'm going to Barbados. Where is that? And I said, it must be near the Bahamas, because there's nothing else out there but the Bahamas, right?
Yeah.
Oh, little did I know. And Barbados, it was really, again, a wonderful learning experience. And I stuck it out as long as I could. But I finally told Jim Abrams, and I said, you know, I can't do this anymore. The cabin was a modified storage cabinet. Rather than run electricity into it, the guy offered to buy me a year's supplies of D-cells for my big boom box to play music on, because he didn't want to rewire the cabin.
Yeah, okay.
It was a shared facilities there between my cabin and the cabin next to me with the band. And the ship was 5,000 tons.
Wow.
Most ships now start at about 60,000 tons.
So how many passengers?
150 passengers maximum. We usually ran with about 100.
Yeah.
And the big thing on this cruise was we took an airline flight over Angel Falls that Jimmy Angels discovered, the highest waterfall in the world down in south in Venezuela. And we went up the Orinoco River to Ciudad Guayana, Venezuela. And at the mouth of the Orinoco, it would pitch and bob like a cork. And I would get so nauseous. I remember my very first show on the ship after leaving Barbados, as we were bouncing around. I had a show the first night. And I'm sick as all get out. And I'm lying in my bunk going, okay, 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 okay. And I would get up and I would grab my pants and lie back down. I'd put my pants on lying down. I'd get up and grab my shirt and lie back down. I got dressed for my show on my back, lying down in my bed. I went up to do the show, props in hand, little restroom outside there, went in there and lost my dinner again. You know, wipe my mouth off. Ladies and gentlemen, Doug Anderson, 30-minute show. I think I did 11, 12 minutes. Walked off stage, threw up again. Cruiser said, go to your cabin, take some Dramamine. We'll see you in the morning.
Yeah, that was nice.
And I would start setting my alarm clock for 4 o'clock in the morning on Wednesdays, because at 7 o'clock we would hit the mouth of the Orinoco River again. And I knew it was going to be bobbing all over the place. So after a while, after doing this, I finally got used to the motion of the ship.
Were you taking Dramamine? I mean, each time you knew you were going
every
into
time.
That?
Every time.
That helped?
I was in a constant haze, and not from any kind of illicit drugs. It was Dramamine.
Hmm.
Just to keep from getting...
Now, you weren't doing illusions, you say, at the time, so that was just kind of a stand-up type of comedy parlor type of a show. For that, for 150 people, that's not many. So, is that right?
In 82... I saw Mike Caven at the PCAM convention, and he was selling his Lincoln Codehanger routine for a very inexpensive price of $100.
$100, remember that?
Okay, yep. Okay.
I got one too.
Here's 4 minutes. I can augment my show, and it's only going to cost me $100.
It's great routine.
I bought it. Yeah, exactly. Brian Gillis, in his lecture notes, had a standing SpongeBob routine, which I still do today in my shows. I think his lecture notes were $10. So all these things that would pack small, play big...
You've been doing for 30 years.
Exactly. And, well, the show that I did for the other
That's right.
Saturday. Yeah, I think I did the SpongeBob routine.
You did that, yes.
That's how long I've been doing that.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you did the Linking coat hangers, too.
Linking coat hangers, Linking rings that I learned in 77.
Yep, from Whit Hayden. Yep.
It's, I like to learn the magic so well that I don't have to look at the prop. I can spend time making eye contact with each and every member in the audience to make that personal connection. Anybody with $100 could buy that great linking coat hanger routine from Mike Caven.
But to break the fourth wall, you need to...
What's the fourth wall?
That's right. There is no fourth wall, then. If you're
I don't know.
If you can engage yourself with the audience and they are engaged with you.
Exactly. So you know who you're reaching and who you aren't reaching, and make it entertaining. So I've done all these tricks for years. This is all leading up to a point of, unfortunately, at the level... Of the pay and everything else, and I really am hesitant to add anything new to the show.
But you did add illusions. I mean, you went from that to...
Correct, yes. Well, I had done the zigzag for Paul Osborne, and I had done the metamorphosis for Paul Osborne, so I've done the zigzag and the subtrunk, and the assistant's revenge, and several of the other ones, the crystal casket... Six times a day. So I already had that down pat as well.
Right.
So when I went to Silver Seas Cruises, and they said, you must do illusions, that was their criteria back then.
Right.
everything that I, okay, I'll bring my crystal casket and the sub trunk and the zigzag all on board. And I already had routines for them that I had rehearsed as much as I had the Lincoln rings.
Sure.
And that was from the opportunity that I had from Paul Osborne to do them over and over again.
So you're being paid more, I assume, for doing illusions than you were with a one-man act, too.
No, I wasn't. I'm glad you brought that up. As an illusionist, I got paid the same amount.
Interesting.
As doing just a stand-up act.
Huh.
And I got to thinking about that. I said, why am I making myself crazy over these, you know, thousands of dollars in props, wondering are they going to get to the ship in Via France in time to join the ship before we leave France and go on to Italy or wherever else we're going, and getting telexes and phone calls saying it was held up in customs, they're going to hold the ship another 2 hours, and they're going to truck it down to the, you know, why?
Yeah.
When I can go into the deck of cards, a set of sponge balls, 4 Lincoln rings, and,
exactly,
and get paid the same amount. And I don't have to worry about sharing a cabin with an assistant,
mm-hmm,
who wants to share the cabin with a head photographer.
Yeah.
Which is fine, too, because that gives me the cabin back to myself. But I had to pay her, so I made even less money.
Oh, that's true. Yeah.
So I finally got to the point that I'm not going to do illusions at all. And that was fine. And when I went to work Premier Cruise Lines, which used to be the official cruise line of Walt Disney World, they did want illusions. And the only one that I needed to do was just the Metamorphosis.
Mm-hmm.
So again, I did all the stand-up stuff and the sub-trunk.
Now, you talk about the sub-trunk. I remember years ago you told me you had had your knees redone because jumping in and out, that you had to have some arthroscopic surgery or something in your knees, or just...
No, actually, that might have been somebody else, and I believe that
Roy
had to have that done. I had a problem with my left foot. And if anybody here does the Metamorphosis, they understand what I was doing, that I would have problems with my left foot.
Yes, okay.
So, and now to drop 250 pounds from a height of 3 feet onto my left foot,
yeah,
would probably break it. So I'm not nearly as quick as I used to be.
Yeah.
But speaking of quickness, here's a fun thing. We did it for a TV commercial for Florida Cypress Gardens. And we pulled the sub trunk right out in front of the theater so we could have the Magic Lantern Theater in the background on the video.
Right.
And he brought the camera up above our heads. And when we did the exchange, she just dropped the curtain. I was so fast back then.
Yeah.
I was inside with everything concealed as
the curtain fell.
And it was a top loader, not an open back.
Yeah.
And you couldn't see it.
Was this a Chalet model?
It was a Chalet, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. George made some great stuff.
George made the great best stuff, I have to agree. Gosh, good quality stuff. Sorry, he's retired. Good quality stuff. So you continued to work cruises then for a long number of years, and then it seems that, as I just said, theme parks have kind of gone out of style. I don't, as far as magicians, I don't hear magicians saying, I want to work theme parks or anything.
Right.
And I have heard a lot of magicians saying that they want to work cruise ships, but that is not necessarily the direction I think people should be looking now for that alternate stream of revenue, because there's not the opportunity to work cruises as there were. There are more cruises ships being built, as I understand it. They're getting larger and larger, but they are hiring fewer and fewer magicians. Would you say that's correct?
I would say that's correct. I signed off a ship in Lima, Peru on January 5, 2009, with no other prospects after that. And I didn't get another ship until December. That's almost an entire full year of working 25 years pretty much straight, and then
right. Nothing.
Right. Now, I know there's other magicians out there that never had a hitch at all.
Mm.
I mean, they're still working.
But that is more the norm, I think, of those who are working less. They're still working, but I don't... I may be wrong, but it seems those I've talked to are working fewer weeks than they used to. Yes, they're still working, but...
Yeah, that I'm not sure about.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it's... I think the cruise line saw the financial typhoon heading our way that we're experiencing
right
now. And they wanted to keep their war chest full.
Mm-hmm.
Unforeseen circumstances, weather out the financial storm, if people don't cruise as much. I understand it as they...
Well, that's the whole business economy right now. I mean, I hear that in the news constantly about how, I don't care what industry that you name, they're all saying that they have a... They're flush with cash, but then that's why people, others are saying, well, why don't you hire more employees? Well, it's just that they're reluctant about the nature of the current economy, and that if they do hire people, but who's going to buy it because they don't have money, and it's just kind of a catch-22 thing right now. So
right.
It's not just the cruise industry. I think it's just businesses in general.
Everywhere.
Who are ordering money, you know.
I think it was either Barron's or Forbes magazine did a story on it and said, one of the industries hit the hardest, and employment in that industry is down 65%. And that industry is entertainment, live entertainment.
Wow.
A 65% drop.
You don't see people like even Copperfield traveling as much as he used to, you know, where he was
okay.
doing 500 shows a year. He may be now, but he's doing them all still in Vegas.
Is that right?
Yeah, and I don't see a lot of touring shows the way they used to be either. Of course, like in the days of Henning and everybody else. I mean, a lot of that has changed. It's just gotten to be more and more difficult. For that matter, I may be wrong, but I don't see, you know, people like, well, any magician, who am I trying to say, Andre Cole, you know, touring, you know, doing the church shows and things. I mean, uh-huh. it's a lot of equipment to haul around, you know, Spencer's, you know,
the
other ones.
Carrying
know.
All the big stuff. Yeah, it's... That's why I'm driving my wife's car instead of the SUV,
mm-hmm.
strictly because I can go farther on $43 and fill up as opposed to less miles and $65
right.
for a fill up.
Right.
And, you know, otherwise I wouldn't be able to do this lecture tour. People don't realize the expense that it costs to get from place to place to do the lecture.
And then the open dates in between, which you're on your own nickel to have to pay
right.
for hotel or
exactly.
whatever else, you know.
Yep.
So it does get to be quite expensive when... It may seem like it's a great deal. You go out on a lecture tour and you're going to do X number of cities. Well, there are those plus cities, those X plus, the in between that you just got time to kill, kind of, so to speak.
Well, I when you and I talked about this almost a year ago now, or
yeah.
a little bit less than a year ago now, so there's a lot of people in these different cities, our friends that I'd love to go see.
Sure.
So I took it from a point of whether I make any money or not, I'm going to have a chance to go see a lot of friends that I haven't seen in a long period of time.
Along the way, right.
And at least, if not completely pay my way, mostly pay my way to get to go do that.
Right, right.
But to take it out of a magic realm for a moment, we had a check engine light come on in the car, and I wanted to make sure it was sound, roadworthy before I started off on the tour. And Johnny at the dealership we go to, we were talking about the state of the economy, and he said, I see it everywhere. I see tires that are coming here that are almost bald now, instead of the, you know, Lincoln head on the penny, you know, check thing,
yeah.
where there's still some tread left that I could use those tires as spares for people that just need one and give them one. These bald, I can't give them away because I could be sued if it blows out. I mean, it's that bald. And instead of getting their oil changed every 3,000 miles, they're waiting every 5,000 or 6,000 miles.
Right.
So as I said, it's happening everywhere. So I think the cruise line saw that coming. So where they would put several of us, let's say four of us, me, the magician, singer, a comedian, a comedy juggler, four variety acts on a cruise ship and pay each of us $2,500 a week, that would be $10,000. Now, these are just numbers. I have no idea what they were making.
Right, right.
But that would say, for this example, that would be $10,000.
Okay.
Well, if they cut out three of us and just keep the one, they save $7,500
sure.
a week.
Three quarters of that.
Times 52 weeks.
Big
times pay. 15 ships.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of serious cash they're saving.
Right.
And I think that's what they were doing. I talked to some friends of mine that were still on board some of the cruise ships. And so who are you working with? Well, we got a magician on board right now, but I don't think he's ever worked ships before. He can't even do one 40-minute show.
Hmm.
Doesn't have enough material. I mean, that's the way I used to be. And I said, well, is he making, he's probably, be, and that was their guess, making less than $1,000 a week.
Well, there was a guy working out of Galveston over here. Don't remember his name, but I want to say he was from India. And I think he is performing, you know, 7 days a week as a close-up guy. And he's working like about 7-8 hours a day, making $50 a day. $50 a day.
Wow.
Yeah. 7 days a week. And I guess in India, maybe that's some good money for some people in certain caste systems. But people who have seen him and have told me about him, I mean, his close-up is flawless. He said he's just really excellent. And just as you have said, obviously the more often you do it, the right. more finely honed
it's going to be. 8 hours a day.
But I don't think they've given him an increase in pay. I mean, so, and we've got those kinds of performers who are good, who are accepting that kind of money, then, you know, that kind of lowers
makes it
the
difficult for everybody
to have a living wage. Right.
Right. Regarding the, you know, the caste system back in India may be very wealthy. I had a staff captain on a cruise ship, Ocean Cruise Lines, the Ocean Islander, many years ago. That was the one that bobbed like a cork.
Yeah, okay.
Talking about the amount of pay and stuff that the crew got versus what the crew staff or the entertainers got. And I said that, well, yes, but back home in the Philippines, you know, it's a lot of money. He said, well, great, but they're not buying soap powder
in the Philippines.
Tomorrow in the Philippines. They're buying it in the same place as you are.
That's right.
So it's costing them a lot of money. Despite how much they can send home, it still costs them a lot of money.
Right.
And back then, they didn't have cell phones and text messages, so they couldn't keep in contact with their family nearly
sure.
as much either.
Sure, sure. Well, as our cigars start to draw low, and start to kind of wind this down then also, I appreciate your time and sharing all these different stories and everything. Any perspective as to the future, as to what you're thinking on... or advice to other magicians?
Advice to other magicians. I'll give you the advice that was shared with me many years ago. I just finished doing a show for $20 for a Halloween show in East Dallas. And I sped down the highway about 90 miles an hour to get from East Dallas to Arlington, Texas, to get in on Halloween night to Six Flags Over Texas to see Harry Blackstone perform.
Senior? Junior? Junior.
Junior, yes. And I watched his show, and after his show was over, a bunch of us stuck around, and he was signing autographs, and he was very gracious, and I asked him, what kind of advice would you give an aspiring magician that would like to do magic for a living? And he did the old saw of, magic is show business. Business being the bigger of the two words.
Right.
Concentrate on the business aspect of it, and as long as you have a good show to sell, you'll make a living at it. And when I do the Shoot from the Hip lecture series, I teach a whole bunch of tricks, and I know there's a lot of hobbyists and a lot of collectors and a lot of semi-pros and that aren't necessarily interested in the business aspect of magic. So I save it for the very end. And I spend about 30 minutes explaining how to get booked at restaurants, how to get booked, what kind of power shots you can use with the decision makers and people like that, and teach them. And so far, the comments that I've gotten, a lot of the people, the majority of the people so far have said, I like that the best.
Mm-hmm.
So learning the business aspect. So my advice to aspiring magicians would be, learn the business aspect of the magic. When somebody says, how much do you charge for a show, and you say $500, and they say, $500? I can't afford that. Please don't immediately say, well, okay, $200.
Yeah.
Come to the lecture. You'll find out why.
Okay. And if people can't attend the lecture, or they're too far away, or listening to this in another country, or after your lecture has already come through, where can they get in touch with you or possibly buy these?
They can call Scott Wells of Southern Lecture Tours and say, we want to book Doug Anderson's lecture for our group, and he'll set it up for you.
At lectures@scottwells.com. But your website is?
The one for the lecture is Thieves Creek. Sorry, I don't even remember it myself.
Thieves or Thieves?
Yeah, Thieves.
With an F, not a V.
Yeah, T-H-I-E-F-S.
Okay.
Hollow, H-O-L-L-O-W, creek.com. And my friend Tim Scarborough, Lindell, down in Florida, said, nobody can remember thieveshollowcreek.com. He said, you should call it something like dougsmagiclecturetour.com. So I went out and bought the domain, dougsmagiclecturetour.com, and it points to the same one.
Okay. And since this podcast is called The Magic Word, my question to you as we close would be, what would you say your magic word is that you use, you live by, could be something from your show, from your life? What is your magic word?
You know, that's scary that you would ask that, because honestly, I don't normally use a magic word.
Yeah.
If I were to have a magic, you know, I do things like uttering magical words like tappy, tap, tap. And when I worked for Disney, we had to use bippity boppity boo,
yeah,
because that was their word.
Sure.
But I would say a good phrasal advice, always be grateful.
Grateful. That's a great one. And with that, I thank you very much, Doug, for your time. Appreciate you being here on The Magic Word. And for now, then, this is Scotty out.